The wall loomed, a rough-hewn barrier of stone and mortar standing between him and the open. Climbing it was a gamble, the risk of being spotted high, but he had no choice. Hauling himself up, muscles screaming, he dropped onto the other side, landing in a cloud of dust. His escape had begun. He had to reach the train yard. Luck, it seemed, was on his side. A freight train, shrouded in gloom, sat idling on the tracks. He slipped into an empty boxcar, the metallic tang of coal dust filling his nostrils. Hours crawled by, punctuated by the rhythmic wheels and the ever-present fear of discovery. But the train was not going far enough. Forced to disembark, he found himself in a mining town. Desperate for refuge, he sought shelter in the dark, echoing depths of a disused coal mine. The air was thick, with a smell of damp earth and decay. He spent days in the mine, avoiding people. It was damp, cold, and he had a sense of hopelessness. Finally, a chance encounter with a sympathetic local led him the next leg of his journey. A train bound for Portuguese East Africa. Hidden amongst the cargo, he endured the long, arduous journey, each mile carrying him closer to freedom. The man who orchestrated this daring escape, a man who would later shape the course of history, was the young, audacious Winston Churchill. Soldier, parliamentary, prime minister, orator, painter, writer, husband and leader all combine to make Winston Churchill one of the most studied humans ever. Most leaders and historians are guaranteed to have at least one book they've read about Churchill. But how many creative people and photographers have? To solve this problem, we are going to read Churchill by Paul Johnson today and extract the key lessons that we can apply to our lives, our photography, our creative practices, and our businesses. And let's get right into the book. Since I read this book, I've definitely taken a lot of kind of leadership assets from Churchill. And just the stories in this book, just that story there, which is a completely true story. He escaped in the middle of a war-torn South Africa and somehow came out alive. He literally escaped a prisoner of war camp. It's just incredible. There's so many more stories packed into this book. So without further ado, let's get into it and start extracting key lessons to improve our lives and our photography. So Paul Johnson has done a few different biographies on people like Picasso and I think Napoleon as well. He's a really good biographer. His books are pretty small, which is good. Not a lot of fluff, straight to the point, all the action that we need to find to learn how to improve ourselves and our photography. So first of all, we're going to go into the first chapter of Churchill's life. And Paul Johnson was actually lucky enough to meet Churchill when he was younger as a boy. He says, "In 1946, when I was 17, I had the good fortune to ask him a question. 'Mr. Churchill, sir, to what do you attribute your success in life?' Great question. Without pause or hesitation, he replied, 'Conservation of energy. Never stand up when you can sit down, and never sit down when you can lie down.'" He then got into his limo. Not so much in his early life, but during his older years, he was definitely well known for waking up in the morning and then staying in bed until noon, just reading or taking calls or speaking to colleagues. And then he would come out of his bed during the afternoon. So he definitely preached what he practiced, but not so much in his younger years. And we'll get into that shortly. Paul Johnson actually talks about it right now in the following paragraph. He says, "Churchill was capable of tremendous physical and intellectual efforts of high intensity over long periods, often with little sleep, but he had corresponding powers of relaxation, filled with a variety of pleasurable occupations. And he also had the gift of taking short naps when time permitted. He spent his mornings in bed, telephoning, dictating, and receiving visitors. Carries on talking about the question that he asked him, which I already just said. Yeah, so he clearly almost didn't quite, I wouldn't say burn the candle at both ends, but Winston Churchill was definitely very active and hardworking, but then he would also have corresponding periods of relaxation. And that's one of Churchill's key kind of attributes that we should take into account is, yeah, he did all of this amazing stuff and achieved so much in his lifetime, but he also had periods of his life where he would be painting or he'd be relaxing and he'd be recharging. Because again, like in many people's stories, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And Churchill definitely adopted that mentality. And I think it's just really good to be aware that we shouldn't just be on the grind 16 hours a day for like our whole lives. Obviously, there'll be some periods of time if we're starting a new company or we're starting photography business or we're working on a massive project that we think needs that amount of time every single day. Of course, you're going to have to do it. But in the long term, I think that will just lead to burnout and therefore inconsistency. I'm definitely one to wake up early, try and work out as quickly as possible in the mornings. But if I feel like I need to recharge, I will have a 25-minute power nap and then a cold shower, which works for me. And then after that, I'm full of energy. My brain's just wired back on almost. It's just not all fuzzy and horrible. So yeah, work hard, but don't be afraid to rest, recharge, and take power naps. Kobe Bryant, in his interviews and biographies, rest in peace, he died a few years ago. He was one to take a lot of cat naps, he called them. So he wouldn't sleep a lot during the day. No, during the night, he would be like training at ridiculous hours, only get a few hours sleep. But in between like practice or after or before games on the coach, when he was in the medical room or stretching, like in the stretching room, he would allow himself to take 10, 15 minute naps. And that's what he needed to then put all his effort and energy into the next session or the next piece of practice. So yeah, there's so much importance of sleep, and try and get 7 to 9 hours. But if you need to nap during the day, don't feel bad for doing it, because you'll just end up being way more productive if you do that rather than trying to just bang your head against your desk and continue to slog on when you could have just taken a 20-minute nap and been fully recharged and done better work straight after. Yeah, so speaking on briefly about his Winston Churchill's parents, his dad died when Winston was 20, and he ended up doing a biography on him. His dad was a politician, and he was very well known, but he ended up being the first Secretary of State for India, and then for 6 months, Chancellor of the Exchequer. But while preparing his first budget, he had a deadly row overspending with the Prime Minister, and he ended up resigning, and he like overplayed his hand, and he never recovered from that mistake. And at the same time, a mysterious progressive illness began to affect him. Some believed it was syphilis, others a form of mental corrosion inherited from his mother's branch of the family. Gradually his speeches became confused and halting and painful to listen, until death in 1895 drew a merciful curtain over his shattered career. So Churchill and his dad weren't close at all. His dad would send him letters when he was in school, and Churchill was often in the bottom set, which is ironic because he ends up self-educating himself and reading a ton of books and ending up being very intelligent and having a wide range of knowledge that he uses to his advantage. But he wasn't a good student, which is often found in a lot of outliers. They're not amazing students. They don't like being told what to do. They want to be in control. But then after school or during their own time, they end up reading loads and educating themselves. But his dad used to send him like horrible letters, basically saying he was a failure and he like would disregard Churchill. And that definitely probably put a lot of fire in Churchill's belly to prove him wrong. But alas, he didn't end up being able to prove him wrong when Lord Randolph was alive. This is quite a common thread in a lot of outliers and highly successful people like Steve Jobs. Winston, it is true, complained of periodic dark moods, which he called the black dog. But these were occasioned by actual reverses and were soon dispersed by vigorous activity. and his health actually ended up being in full possession of his faculties, despite his mind, even though he physically became worse when he got older, his mind ended up being still really sharp, even up until his death. But yeah, he had huge passion for life in all aspects. His aim to be the most important politician in Westminster was a male projection of his mother's intense desire to be the most desirable lady in Mayfair. So his mother was American. Paul Johnson says she was also very much an American. She believed the sky was the limit, that everything was possible. That tradition precedes the right way of living or acting that could always be ignored when ambition demanded. She loved high risk and did not weep for long anyway, if they did not come off. And she transmitted all of this in her firstborn son, Winston. So yeah, Churchill definitely didn't act like a Victorian British man. He was very much more like Teddy Roosevelt, the famous American prime minister, president, who we'll be doing future episodes on. And I think that is really important, because the influence his mother had on him and the kind of nature he had went against the grain. And although he got a lot of resistance for acting this way, it ended up benefiting him greatly, because he was scared to take risk and didn't loathe in a lot of criticism and just kept getting on with it. And I think it's still the case. There's definitely still tall poppy syndrome in the UK, where the tallest poppy gets its head cut off. Don't stand out. Don't try and do things differently. It's very cynical. And I think the UK would be a lot better without it. I know that America is the opposite of that. They encourage everyone to try and do great things, or a lot of people to do great things. That's how they're brought up there, which obviously has its negatives as well. But not enough people in the UK try and stand out and try and be great, even though they could easily be. And Winston is a physical example of that. So I think we should all have that outlier mentality, where we actually believe we can be something and do something before we actually achieve it, because belief comes before ability. And once you have physical proof that you are who you believe you are, that's when you'll prove everyone wrong. But in the meantime, you just have to keep believing, I can do this and I can be the best. And that's exactly what Winston Churchill did, even though he went through many ups and downs in his career, which we'll get into. His father soon wrote him off as an academic failure, and he never got out of the bottom form. Lord Randolph's letters to him are crushing, indeed brutal. So that's what I was saying earlier about his dad being incredibly harsh to him for not doing well in school. Yeah, so Winston Churchill was born in aristocracy. He had a long family lineage of kind of successful people, but that was mainly attributed to, I think he's called like the Duke of Marlborough, who was like one of the best army generals in British history. He like never lost a battle, and that ended up providing like status for generations after him, including Churchill's. When Churchill's dad died in 1895, all had to be sold to pay his debts. It was clear by then that Winston would have to earn his own living. So he didn't actually have a lot of financial backing throughout his life, and he ended up being really hit hard by the 1920s financial crisis and the Great Depression, and lost all of investments. But luckily, he had writing and speaking as one of his true kind of gifts in life, which made him a substantial income. But he never really inherited much money, which probably a lot of people didn't realize. They probably just think, oh, Churchill, he's from an aristocratic family, he didn't try hard. But it's the complete opposite. Whilst a lot of people in that status level at the time, and probably now, didn't do much with their life, Churchill was the complete opposite. He said about that there's wastrels at both ends of the scale, which is interesting, that it just shows how important hard work is. No matter what class you're in, no matter what cards you're dealt, you still have to work hard and have a purpose in life. Otherwise, you'll just end up regretting being lazy. Yeah, so it says words were also his main source of income throughout his life from the age of 21. Yes, this is incredible. He wrote thousands of articles for newspapers and magazines and over 40 books. Some were very long. His account of the Second World War is over 2,050,000 words. Yeah, wrote between 8 and 10 million words. And there can be very few boys who made such profitable use of something learned at school. In that sense, Winston's education, contrary to the traditional view, was a notable success. So yeah, he just worked on his strengths, which was writing for him, and ended up making a substantial income from it. As for us, if photography's strength, or if speaking's our strength, or if creating content's our strength, just hone in on that and try to make a business out of it, try and make money from it, because you'd rather be doing that than be doing a job you hate, right? So that's what Churchill did. And I think that's what a lot of creative people should try to do more of, try and make a career out of their passion. Yeah, so he was really interested in war. He wanted to win medals. He wanted the prestige of a successful soldier. And then he would use that success to pivot into politics and end up being the prime minister. So he had a blueprint, he had a game plan right from the start, Winston Churchill did. And he ended up being a war correspondent in quite a few wars, and also fighting in a lot of them. And the author says he was under fire, I calculate, about 50 times in the course of his life, and never once hit by a bullet. And he was not the only outsider who came to Cuba for experience. Theodore Roosevelt, his older contemporary, led a force of freebooters there. The two men had a great deal in common, but did not get on. Roosevelt said, "That young man Churchill is not a gentleman. He does not rise to his feet when a lady enters the room." That may be true. Once Churchill was comfortably in his chair, he was reluctant to rise, part of his conservation of energy principle. So there's a lot of parallels between Teddy Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. And I think we're definitely going to be doing some episodes on Teddy Roosevelt, because a lot of different biographies I've been reading, like Bob Dylan's and Edward Box, which we'll be doing episodes on in the next few weeks, have mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. And his maxim is get action. And I think he's probably one of the greatest presidents in US history. So the fact that Churchill was being compared to him shows that he's like the real deal. He really is an outlier. Ends up going to India, and he says once in India, he looked about him for action, but he was not idle while waiting for opportunities. Churchill was conscious of his ignorance and begged his mother to send him big, important books. She did. And he devoured like different books, like The History of England and really famous author Gibbon's books. He read The Martyrdom of Man, which turned him into a lifelong freethinker and critic of organized religion. He read everything of value he could get his hands on and forgot nothing he read. But there were always gaps, he felt, in his knowledge, which he eagerly filled when vital books were recommended to him. So I wrote a note here saying, be conscious of your ignorance and fill it. So Churchill was complete and utter devourer of books, which I hope listening to this podcast for you is a form of doing, and I hope it encourages you to buy and read the books that I'm extracting lessons from for you. But every single person I've studied so far has just rambled on about how important it is to educate yourself by reading books, whether it's Steve Jobs, whether it's Edward Bok, whether it's Bob Dylan, who I'm reading a book on right now. He was obsessed with reading. He devoured books like Churchill did. If you ever find yourself interested in something, just go buy a book and read about it, or listen to this podcast and then buy a book about it, because it's such an advantage in the digital era where most people just scroll on Instagram or TikTok and don't really learn anything from it. The ability to read and the power of reading is like almost forced meditation. Really famous investor Li Lu, or it might be Charlie Munger, said, as long as I'm reading, I feel like I'm not wasting my time. And I think that is so true. And when we fall into the busy trap of trying to fit as many things in that aren't necessarily essential, we sacrifice time to do other things like recharging and reading, which feeds our mind. If the best way to improve your health is to go on a run or go to the gym, I think the best way to improve your mind is to read books and read biographies about outliers and then apply those lessons to your life. And if you can't do that, or if you're on the run, or if you're commuting, or if you're cleaning, the best alternative is listening. And if you listen to this podcast, you'll be downloading information into your brain from these highly successful people, which will in turn hopefully benefit your life, even if it's 5-10 years from now. The information will be in your mind and you'll unexpectedly be able to deliver or do something that completely changed your life just from reading like a £10 book. Charlie Munger says there's $1 billion worth of ideas in a $30 history book. So it's super important. In fact, it's so important, I'm going to quickly do a little sneak peek for a future episode and read an excerpt from Bob Dylan's book because he emphasizes this so well. So be right back. He said, it was said that World War II spelled the end of the Age of Enlightenment, but I wouldn't have known it. I was still in it. Somehow I could still remember and feel the light of something about it. I'd read that stuff. Voltaire, Rousseau, John Locke, Montesquieu, Martin Luther, visionaries, revolutionaries. It was like I knew those guys, like they'd been living in my backyard. So that was an excerpt from Bob Dylan's autobiography, which is incredible and we'll be reading soon. But I think it just sums it up perfectly why we should study history's greatest people and outliers. Because you become, as Charlie Munger says, you become friends with the eminent dead. You have a little like Winston Churchill, or little Teddy Roosevelt or Rousseau or David Yarrow or Robert Mapplethorpe or whatever. One, like, just pick anyone that you want to study and you find interesting in your head. So when you come up with challenges or experiences in your life that you didn't necessarily expect or weren't prepared for, there will be wisdom and lessons that you can use and apply to your life when you're in those situations that you would never have been able to use if you hadn't read the book or studied the person. And it really changes the way we think. Learning is changing your behavior, not memorization. So if we read these books about highly successful people and then change our behavior, that's going to lead to a higher chance of us succeeding in life. Because if it worked for them, it's clearly an effective blueprint for potentially our success if we apply it to the conditions in our life. Obviously, don't just blindly copy someone from 100 years ago. It might not work. But just, yeah, become friends with the eminent dead and study history's greatest people. And by listening to the podcast, you'll be doing that with me. So let's get right back into the book. Churchill reads everything of value he could get his hands on and forgets nothing he reads. But Churchill always felt there were gaps in his knowledge, right? And he was eager to fill these gaps with reading more books. I think that is a very good trait to have, right? To have that curiosity, to just follow what you're naturally interested in. And then the more you read, the more you realize what you don't know, and the more you realize you have to read more and read different books. And I think just repeating that over and over again is going to lead to a lot of compounding of knowledge, because knowledge does compound, like Warren Buffett says. So the more we read, the more it's going to compound, the more intelligent we're going to get, and the more we can succeed and triumph over the problems in life, because human nature repeats itself. Whatever's happened 200 years ago, 500 years ago, it's probably going to happen again. So if we know what to expect from studying these people, I think that's a win for us. Like Ansel Adams, Churchill was very hyperactive but more sedentary in his later existence. But yeah, that's quite a key thread. A lot of successful people actually tend to seem to have a bit of ADHD or they just have some like quirks. They're a bit different. So yeah, I just found that really interesting how that kind of overlaps with Ansel Adams, who admitted he was very hyperactive and struggled in school as a child. So if you're hyperactive or don't enjoy school or formal education, don't worry, because if you follow the footsteps of these giants, I'm sure you'll end up being successful yourself. Again, like Steve Jobs, Churchill then and always was a mass of contradictions. And also like Arnold Schwarzenegger, humans are complex, right? And I think outliers are even more complex than normal people, or at least they openly have the courage to show their kind of faults and complexities. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it actually makes you stand out if you are like that. So don't be afraid to express your full self and just be truthful and be honest and be a bundle of contradictions, because yeah, people might not like it in the short term, but they'll remember you for it. Churchill says an interesting thing about his mindset towards money. He says he always put happiness before money. Anyway, he had never had any doubt that he would earn anything required. As he laid down, income should be expanded to meet expenditure. I found that interesting. I think putting happiness and fulfillment before money is incredibly important. And if you can combine what you love doing with earning money, I think that's like the ideal situation. But a lot of people that end up being really rich that are outliers do end up doing what they love and not caring too much about making loads of money from it. Steve Jobs, obviously really successful and made billions of pounds, but he could have made much more. And he said, I don't want to be the richest person in the graveyard. He was more focused on making insanely great products, which subsequently ended up making loads of money as a result. But it wasn't what he initially had in his mind. He just wanted to do something he loved and make amazing products. And if the product's good enough and the public love it, then money will come as a byproduct of that. And I think we have to do that when we make our work and our photos and do our creative projects. Obviously, we want to sell it and be able to market it and make a profit from it. But first and foremost, we have to have that high standard for our work, because that will make us more fulfilled and happy. And then if it's higher quality work, it's more likely to be desired by other people and therefore make money. So it's just a positive feedback loop. But a lot of people get it mixed the wrong way around. They think, oh, to be happy, I need to make money. Therefore, I'm going to become a lawyer and work 6 days a week for 12 hours a day in a job that I hate to get what I thought was going to make me happy, which was money. And it turns out that isn't always the case from reading books about people and from people I know. So yeah, just try and think like Churchill and put happiness before money. So something that was notable in Churchill's life and a lot of outliers' lives are a supportive spouse. Paul Johnson says, given Churchill's adventurous and reckless nature, his appetite for sensation, his fidelity is notable. It may be that he put all his energy into his political life. Certainly, the marriage was spared many of the irritating rubs of close proximity. For Churchill's hours, up late arguing with colleagues, rising at lunchtime after working in bed, meant that they led separate existences under the same roof. They had their own bedroom right from the start. Whatever the reason, fidelity was a godsend and an important contributing factor to Churchill's success, for he was saved of all the worry and emotional storm which adultery provokes. And he was delighted in his marriage, happy man. And that is super important, having a supportive spouse and staying loyal to that person is just a must. If you want to avoid a terrible existence and you want to be a failure, a great way to do that is to mess up your partnership or romantic partnership or marriage. So Churchill definitely succeeded in life, partly because he had his wife beside him and he stayed faithful to her. Obviously, a lot of us probably know Churchill for his amazing speeches, and they seem really natural, but like Steve Jobs, he spent hundreds of hours perfecting his speeches. And the reason why he did this is interesting. The author says, Churchill had always prepared his speeches carefully, but not word for word. In 1904, he had a horrible experience of drying up in the House of Commons when apparently in full flow. Thereafter, he learned everything by heart, rehearsed and timed himself, and left nothing to chance. Preparation is everything, whether we're doing a photography project, whether we're doing a presentation, whether we're speaking in front of a live audience. The more preparation you do, the higher the chance of you succeeding and the less anxious you're going to feel. And after a terrible experience of drying up in the Commons, Churchill learned from that mistake and now, well, thereafter, ended up just putting so much time and so much energy into perfecting his speeches, which I think we should do as well when we prepare for our creative projects and pursue. So skipping ahead, this is really interesting. Winston Churchill was actually an incredible painter and artist, which I had no idea before reading this book. He discovered, as other sensible people have done, that painting is not only the best of hobbies, but refuge in the time of trouble. For while you are painting, you can think of nothing else. His first painting, The Garden at Hoe Farm, with Goonie in the foreground, survives. Soon, misery began to retreat. His mind, his self-respect, his confidence were restored. He found he could paint strikingly and loved it. His efforts improved with each canvas. His colours were strong and cheerful. His friends liked them and were delighted to have them. Painting, after politics and the family, became his chief passion, and he painted for the rest of his life, as the perfect relaxation from tremendous cares. His eventual election as an honorary Royal Academician Extraordinary in 1948 may have been coloured by his wartime eminence, but it's a compelling fact that Lord Duveen, the leading art dealer of the century, and a few other people, like top art people, formed a committee to award a prize to works of art submitted anonymously by amateur artists. The three gave it instantly and unanimously to Churchill's submission, Winter Sunshine. And Duveen found it hard to believe that the painter was an amateur. So definitely search up Churchill's paintings. They're actually really good, and they've racked up huge prices since his death in the following decades after it. And the fact that Lord Duveen, who was Larry Gagosian before Larry Gagosian fully copied Lord Duveen. Gagosian is the leading art dealer in the world right now. The fact that Lord Duveen was surprised that it was an amateur, he couldn't believe it, shows the level of skill Churchill had at actually painting. But I would never have expected Winston Churchill to be such a good painter. But he clearly found refuge in it. He clearly gave him peace of mind. And again, like we said before, the power of relaxation is clearly embedded in Churchill's success story. So take notes, guys, because we need to not just be working 24/7 around the clock. We should also have time to rest, recharge, and do stuff like painting and reading and journaling so we can stay consistent and not burn out. So a key lesson that I remember a lot of the time in my day-to-day existence from Churchill is a really simple yet powerful quote. When he was making his house, the author Paul Johnson says, "It has big windows, which Churchill liked." And Churchill says, "Light is life." And I think that is so important, and especially for photographers and artists, right? We use light as the source of life in our work. And without light, we can't make anything. We can't even exist. So utilizing light to our advantage when we try and create stunning photos is definitely an effective thing to do, whether it's positioning yourself so you work against the light like David Yarrow does, or creating kind of a contrast light like chiaroscuro, like in a lot of paintings. Light is super, super important, not just for our well-being mentally, but also our creative work. So if you're not focusing on what the light will look like in your images, and you're not visualizing and going out at sunrise or sunset, if you're a photographer, definitely start doing that, because as soon as you start utilizing golden hour and thinking about the light before anything else, if you start doing that, your photos will dramatically improve for sure. Even if you look at episode 1 and 2 and probably number 3 as well, like previous episodes, the difference in light in just like the setup I'm in right now is made such a difference to like the production quality and aesthetic to the video. So I just think it's super important, and it's something we should definitely spend a lot of time perfecting, is like where we position the lights, or what the light looks like in our image, and where are we in relation to the lights, and whether we put a key light on this side of our face or that side, or if we include backlighting. The more we learn about light, the better our work will get. Skipping ahead again, he was crossing Fifth Avenue in the dark and looked the wrong way, because in England, fast cars come from the opposite direction, and it knocked him down, and he was badly damaged on the head, thighs, ribs, and in terrible pain. But he remained conscious, and when a policeman asked what had happened, he insisted it was entirely his own fault. He was in fact lucky to be alive. A taxi took him home, and he was a long time recovering. Churchill was very down. He told his wife, Clemmy, "I've now in the last 2 years had heavy blows. First, the loss of all that money in the crash and the Great Depression. then the loss of my political position in the Conservative Party, and now this terrible physical injury. He was afraid he would never recover from these blows. In fact, he began the process while still in hospital by dictating a moving and thoughtful article about his accident. I certainly suffered every pang, mental and physical, that a street accident or, I suppose, a shell wound can produce. None is unendurable. There is neither the time nor the strength for self-pity. There's no room for remorse or fears. If at any moment in this long series of sensations, a grey veil deepening into blackness had descended upon the sanctum, I should have felt or feared nothing additional. Nature is merciful and does not try her children, man or beast, beyond their compass. It is only when the cruelty of man intervenes that hellish torments appear. For the rest, live dangerously, take things as they come, fear naught, all will be well. It was the largest sum he'd ever received for a single piece of writing, and it was printed everywhere. And he went back to the fray, shaken but calm, to live more dangerously than ever before, but to fear even less. I think that's super important. Churchill suffers three, like, horrible situations in his life in quick succession, and he still doesn't loaf in his own self-pity. Charlie Munger says it. Self-pity has no utility. How many times have I been saying that in these episodes? He could have just lied there and been defeatist and just never come back. And if that happened, we'd probably be speaking German right now. So if Churchill, in such a horrible moment in his life, had the strength to pull himself out and not just sit around pitting himself, I think we can all do it when we go through struggles in our lives. Obviously, you're going to feel like terrible when things happen, and that's inevitable. But it's whether you can bounce back from that and turn what's negative eventually into a positive. Yeah, that's definitely a lesson for us to learn, especially as creative people, as founders, or as businessmen, or whatever you're doing with your life, especially if it's something you're passionate about and you're not in a like conventional job. You're going to go through ups and downs, but you cannot pity yourself. You just have to think of solutions, and you have to keep enduring. By endurance we conquer, like Ernest Shackleton says. So yeah, avoid self-pity at all costs. So we're going to skip towards the beginnings of World War II. And this is how Churchill ends up becoming Prime Minister and eventually leading Britain to victory and the Allies to victory in World War II. This is how it all began. By 6 p.m. on Friday, May the 10th, Churchill got the job he had worked for. 12 hours earlier, the Germans had begun the decisive campaign against France. Early reports were bad as Churchill was forming his cabinet. He did not get to bed till 3 a.m, but his courage was high. He recorded, "I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. At last I had the authority to give directions over the whole scene. I felt as if I had been walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but preparation for this hour and for this trial. 10 years in the political wilderness had freed me from ordinary party antagonisms. My warnings over the past 6 years had been so numerous, so detailed, and were now so terribly vindicated that no one could gainsay me. I could not be reproached either for making the war or with want of preparation for it. I thought I knew a good deal about it all, and I was sure I would not fail. Therefore, although impatient for the morning, I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams." This is so powerful. Ever since he was a boy, he'd wanted to be Prime Minister, and he was one of the only people in the country in a high position that was encouraging us, Britain or the UK, to fight back at the Nazis. And did he rise to the occasion? Eventually he did. And just the belief you have to have, "I was sure I would not fail, and all that my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial." And after being in the political wilderness for 10 years, it all worked to his advantage. But obviously at the time, he would never have known this. But it just shows the importance of preparation for big projects that we're doing as creative people and as business owners and entrepreneurs, and belief that you're not going to fail. The only way Churchill was going to fail is if he was killed. And we have to have that mentality if we want to do something big with our lives. And yeah, I say he had visualized and manifested this moment. He'd worked hard for it and therefore prepared to be the best. His dreams, his passion has been materialized. After all the failure, struggle, he persevered and was finally rewarded. So if you're struggling right now, if you're failing right now, if you just need hope that it's all going to work out, just think about Winston Churchill when he was in the wilderness for 10 years, not in politics, thinking he was failing at life and there was no chance he'd achieve his dream of becoming prime minister. He ends up becoming prime minister and helping the Allies win World War II. And that had to come from a massive sense of belief and a massive amount of preparation in the years before, which we all need to have if we want to do anything successful with our lives. Churchill's mission was simple and clear. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and hard the road may be. For without victory, there is no survival. I think we can apply that to our lives as people wanting to become outliers and succeed. You just have to win at all costs and suffer short-term failures and short-term problems, but you just have to adapt and try and work your way through it. You either adapt or you die. And yeah, just thinking to yourself, I have to win at all costs and I am a winner and I can do this, will definitely increase your chances of succeeding versus the kind of opposite mindset that would be, oh, I'm such a failure, I'm going to fail and I'll be fine if I don't succeed. No, we have to have that black and white mindset that Churchill had in World War II, which was victory over everything at all costs. So Churchill was known for his power of relaxation and recharging, but in moments where he needed to and where it demanded, he was not shy of working incredibly long hours. He says he worked 16 hours a day. He sought to make everyone else do likewise. In contrast to lethargic, self-indulgent old Asquith, or even Lloyd George, who had high tea instead of a proper dinner to discuss strategy and went to bed at 9 o'clock, Churchill began to wear his own form of labour-serving uniform, a siren suit, easy to put on and take off, which he could nap in if he wanted during long spells at night to work. This added hugely to the fast-accumulating Churchill legend. The public called it his rompers. In fact, thanks to Clemmie, some of these siren suits were of elaborate and costly materials, velvet and silk, as well as wool. Churchill would always use clothes for personal propaganda and had to collect unusual uniforms. Yeah, he worked hard, encouraged everyone to do so as well, and they had to rise to Churchill's standards. Churchill wasn't going to fall to theirs. I think that's incredibly important for outliers who are trying to lead a team of people. If you're in a small startup or you've made your own photography business and you're the CEO, you need to, the employees or the people that are working with you need to rise to your standards and you have to set the bar. Even if it's unreasonable, if they see you doing it, they're more likely to do it as well. You can't just sit back and be ordering and barking at people telling to do stuff when you're just like not doing anything and not working hard. You have to be the example and the minimum standard. You have to be a yardstick for quality, as Steve Jobs says, which Churchill certainly was in this period of World War II. So this is the iconic Churchill speech that everyone is probably aware of. Like we said, though, in the previous chapters, how much preparation would Churchill have gone before presenting this to make sure it was exactly how he visualized? Churchill says, "We shall not fail. We shall not flag or fail. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." I say, like next to it, iconic, no word was wasteful. And it's so powerful. And it definitely rallied the morale of the entire country at the time. And it's still iconic to this day. But he would have gone through so much preparation to really put the point home. It wouldn't have been just improvised, because Churchill, like Steve Jobs, did so much preparation for his speeches. And we have to do so much preparation for our speeches and our podcasts or our creative works, our photos or our projects. Preparation is everything if you want to be successful. And the public praises people for what they practice in private. If you see anyone who's at the top of their capacity, like a Michael Jordan or a Cristiano Ronaldo or a Winston Churchill, what they're doing seems so easy because they've spent so much time putting the reps in, putting the work in, practicing and iterating until it looks effortless. And that's exactly what we have to do as well if we want to succeed at whatever we're doing. This is a really interesting piece of history, the Battle of Britain. It was just, I think the Germans had way more aircraft and Britain had to catch up and produce loads. And the Battle of Britain's really significant for me, informative for me, because I'm from Kent and a lot of the fights would have been happening directly over my house, obviously 80 years before I lived in the house. But there's still evidence of loads of different radars and pillboxes and stations all around Kent and Sussex for when there were dogfights in the sky between the Germans and the English. Like, imagine being in Britain in World War II. You're this island, and if you look towards mainland Europe, the entire coastline is occupied by the enemy. You're completely surrounded. And then you see these Messerschmitt 109s and 110s like coming in, doing air raids on towns, blowing up, like flattening cities and London, while you have to hide underground in fear all night, hearing these bombs go off. And then during the day, you're seeing these like dogfight skirmishes in the sky. And you know that if Britain loses this air fight, Operation, I think it's called Operation Sea Lion, the Germans would have just come straight towards the UK. So the fact that the underdogs of the Battle of Britain, the Allies, the UK, the RAF, won was a turning point at the start of the war. Because if the Allies didn't win the Battle of Britain, a full-fledged invasion from the Nazis would have happened. And yet, as Britain, the Royal Air, like the RAF, were beating the Luftwaffe, the German Nazi Air Force, and victory was on its way for the Battle of Britain, Churchill commended them, saying, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." This is really good. Churchill during the war was very gifted, and throughout his whole life, very gifted for having and for getting his priorities right. His personal secretary said, "Churchill's greatest intellectual gift was for picking on essentials and concentrating on them. But these essentials were always directed towards the destruction of the enemy." That is so good, because after reading the book Essentialism, it's actually better to do less, but better. And the fact Churchill was able to pick on the essentials and then ignore everything else that was unimportant or trivial led to not only his success, but probably the entire success of Britain in World War II. And I think we can apply that to our lives by when we write to-do lists or things we think we have to do, we got to just pick like the 1 to 3 things that are actually going to get us a step closer towards our goals rather than trying to do it all at once. If you try and do everything, you do nothing, right? So we have to be essentialists in our lives if we want to succeed and become like our ideal selves. I think doing that and just picking up on the essentials and focusing on a few things, the 20% of things that give you 80% of the results, is probably the most effective way to be great at anything. Most people become successful by focusing on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. So if you want to be the best photographer of all time, or want to be the best artist, or be a highly successful thing at whatever you're passionate about, you're going to have to focus on that one thing and basically ignore a lot of other things as well. Now, Churchill, obviously, like this book says, had times to relax, and he spent a lot of time with his family as well, and did a bit of painting, right? That's three or four things: politics, family, and painting. He focused on them few things because it gave him the most success and happiness. So pick three things that you love doing and focus on them things and try and ignore everything else, right? For me, it's like the few things I love doing is photography, reading, working out, and this podcast. I'm just going to focus on those things for decades. And I think that's going to give me a higher chance of success than focusing on 20 different things and trying to fit it all in every single day and then just end up getting nowhere. So yeah, get your priorities right. Be an essentialist like Winston Churchill. So again, talking about Churchill's artwork, the news of his skill as a landscape painter was spreading. The rich began to collect his work. His canvases fetched high prices in the auction rooms. It got approval from the Royal Academy president, and nothing in Churchill's life gave him greater pleasure than painting. He sent his pictures to the summer exhibition and always, if he could, attended the annual banquet. This was in relation to the Royal Academy that he was elected into because of his success in World War II and art. But yeah, I think just following what you're genuinely interested in, even if it seems like a contradiction to your character, for example, Churchill with painting, is the best kind of approach in life. Because if you love it, you're going to endure and pursue it. Even during tough times, you're not going to get bored and you're going to be really experiencing life to its fullest. I think the best way to have a good life is to spend as much time doing what you love. And if you can make a profit from doing that, which allows you to spend more time doing it, then it's a win-win. I think learning from Churchill's kind of philosophy of just focusing on the few things that you love, even if it's like something unexpected, like painting for him is, we can really live a fulfilled life. And if people judge you for taking up painting when you should be into football or whatever, like just for a random example, ignore it, because in the long run, what are you going to enjoy more? Like pretending you like something because other people do, or because you have a genuine passion for it? That's a great way to expel regrets, is to just do what you love and not do things that people expect you to do. For example, drinking alcohol, for example, hanging out with a group of people you don't actually like, or playing a sport just because it's popular. Just follow your gut, follow what you actually enjoy doing. And the older you get, I think the less judgment you'll get from others, and you'll eventually succeed and people will just accept you for who you are, which is better than pretending to be someone you're not, right? So Churchill ends up not getting into the new government after World War II. But again, he says, "I will never give way to self-pity." And that's, again, super important. Self-pity has no utility. Even when we go through hardship and struggle, I really still try and think we should maintain somewhat of a positive mindset and try and positively reframe it, because it's going to be hard to do that, obviously, especially during the time. But all these people that we've been studying on this podcast, it's just repeated in almost every single book. Just don't loathe in self-pity and give up. You just have to keep going, keep succeeding. And a lot of the things I'm saying here, like if you don't agree with it or think, I don't know, like why, what right does he have to say this? It's like notes to self. I'm talking to you guys and I hope you guys take it into account as well, because this is information from history's most successful people and like experts in the world right now. And I'm just trying to brainwash myself almost to believe this stuff and really change my behavior as a consequence of it, because I know they have succeeded by doing this and it keeps being repeated in different people from different eras, then it's certainly true wisdom and is almost like a truth. So self-pity has no utility. I will never give way to self-pity. We should do the same thing as well if we want to make the most out of life and succeed. Ending, going towards the end of the book now, Paul Johnson, the author, has a few lessons that he's extracted from the book, which I think is going to be really good for us to go through. So the first lesson is always aim high. As a child, Churchill received no positive encouragement from his father and little from his mother. He was aware of failure at school. but he still aimed high. He conquered his aversion of math at least enough to pass. He reinforced success in what he could do, write a good English sentence. And conscious of his ignorance, he set himself to master English history and familiarize himself with great chunks of literature. Once his own master, he played polo to win the top award in the world. He got himself into 5 wars in quick succession and became both a veteran of military law and one of the world's most experienced and highly paid war correspondents. He then set his sights for the House of Commons and stayed there with one lapse for over half a century. He sought power and got it in growing amplitude. He never caged or demeaned himself to get to office, but obtained it in his own terms. He sought to be Prime Minister, feeling only he could achieve certain things. In 1940, he aimed not only high, but at the highest, to rescue a stricken country in danger of being demoralised, to put it firmly on his feet again and to carry it to salvation and victory. He did not always meet his elevated targets, but by always aiming high, he always achieved something worthwhile. Such good lessons. Aim high. Belief comes before ability. If we want to succeed, we have to truly believe in ourselves and visualize that success. Because if you want to do something, how are you going to get there if you don't actually believe it yourself? You have to believe before you have the proof. And that's exactly what Churchill did. And that's exactly what we should do as people wanting to become successful. Lesson number 2 is, there's no substitute for hard work. Churchill obscured his moral by his, for him, efficient habit of spending a working morning in bed. He also manifestly enjoyed his leisure activities, for him, another form of hard work, to keep himself fit and rested and to enable himself to do his job at the top of his form. The balance he maintained between flat-out work and creative and restorative leisure is worth study by anyone holding a top position. But he never evaded hard work itself. Taking important and dangerous decisions, the hardest form of work there is, in the course of a 16-hour day. Or working on a speech to bring it as near to perfection as possible. No one ever worked harder than Churchill to make himself a master orator. Or forcing himself to travel long distances, often in acute discomfort and danger, to meet the top statesman face to face, where his persuasive charm could work its best. He worked hard at everything to be the best of his ability. Mistakes he made constantly, but there were never anything shoddy or idle about his work. He put tremendous energy into everything and was able to do this because he conserved his energy too. There was an extraordinary paradox about his white, apparently flabby body and the amount of muscle power he put into his life, always. Super important. There's no substitute for hard work. It's so true. We have to work hard at whatever we do. And even during leisure activities like painting or reading and stuff that isn't like conventional work, we should work hard at that as well. Humans are made to work hard. And I think the more idle we are, the worse off we're going to get and the more we're going to regret not trying harder when we're older. Third lesson from Churchill, and in its way, the most important. Churchill never allowed mistakes, disaster, personal or national, accidents, illnesses, and unpopularity and criticism to get him down. His powers of recuperation, both in physical illness and in psychological response to abject failure, were astounding. To be blamed for the dreadful failure and loss of life in the Dardanelles was a terrible burden to carry. Churchill responded by fighting out on the Western Front in great discomfort and danger, and then by doing a magnificent job at the Ministry of Munitions. He constantly made a fool about himself, but he had the courage, most important of all virtues, to continue. These strengths are inborn, but they can be also cultivated, and Churchill worked on them all his life. In a sense, his whole career was an exercise in how courage can be displayed, reinforced, guarded, and doled out carefully, heightened and concentrated. Those uncertain of their courage can look to Churchill for reassurance and inspiration. Yeah, so having the courage to bounce back from failure is certainly a trait we should all be taking from Churchill if we want to succeed in our lives. The last 2 lessons from Churchill are, don't waste time and energy on trivial things. Be an essentialist. Pick the few things that you love, that you want to do and you care about, and just work flat out of those things and ignore everything else that you think is unimportant. And also, there's nothing more draining and exhausting than hatred. And Churchill loved to forgive and make up, and the absence of hatred left plenty of room for joy in Churchill's life. It must never be forgotten that Churchill was happy with people. So I think that's the last lesson that really hits home, is be a people person. Obviously, spend time by yourself in solitude, but also avoid hate, avoid resent, because resent also has no utility, as well as self-pity. Envy does run the world, not greed, but we need to get rid of our envy as soon as possible, and that will give us more energy to focus on what we love and ourselves and the people we love around us. So yeah, that is where I'll leave it. And no one did more to preserve the values we hold dear. How did one man do so much for so long and so effectively? If you want to find out more, read this book. The link in the show notes below will allow you to do that. And if you buy the book using the link in the description, you'll be supporting the show at no extra cost to you. And if you want to have early, like a sneak preview of who will be coming onto the show, because I'll be doing guests very soon. The next episode you'll be listening to will be from guests. I'm getting some really famous photographers and authors onto the show very soon, which I'm super excited about. Not just studying books, but of history's greatest people, but we'll also be studying experts that are living today. So stay tuned for that. And if you want to get my reading list, as well as newsletters and things I'm learning throughout the week, and want to get early access to all of that for free, there's also a link to my Substack below as well, which is completely free and will give you early access and all previews to guests and so much value. And yeah, that is where I'll leave it. Until next time, take the lessons from this book, buy the book yourself, and keep improving. See you later.